Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Raven Real Spill. This is your girl, Raven the Serial Poet, come to bring to y'all another night of 31 Days of Horror. This will be night 24. We coming around the mountain, y'all. We coming around the mountain. Halloween will be Sunday. I don't know what y'all going to be, but I know what I'm going to be. I am going to be in my bed. Because it's too much corona, too much violence, and too much everything going on right now. So, yeah, you won't catch me outside. But be safe. Whatever you do, be safe in all things that you do and the people that you are around. But before we get into the show, call in at 914-205-5813. That's 914-205-5813. If you're listening to the playback, thank you. I love you and appreciate it. Now let's get into the show.
Not long ago, I went to see my older cousin. He lived in a remote rural village. I was a teenager without a driver's license, so I took the bus. However, I accidentally ended up taking the wrong bus. This bus was going to another town. Inevitably, I got off in the middle of the road. It was a 40-minute walk from there to my brother's house. Also, the area was so remote that there were very few buses around there. I ended up just deciding to walk. There were only fields around, and not a single person was seen passing by. Just then, I saw some scarecrows standing in the field, which was very unusual. They all looked like real people. I looked at one of the scarecrows. They must have set up some mannequins, I thought. Curious, I came a little closer, and they were even more shocking up close. The mannequin seemed much more real than I had thought. The skin looked real. It felt like a real person was standing here. I got goosebumps all over me. I looked at them vacantly, thinking, what are these for? The scarecrows all stood in the same position. They were standing in a strange position with their body tilted at an angle. It was such a strange and creepy sight. Just then, one of the scarecrow's eyes suddenly moved and stared at me. I was so surprised that I fell back. The scarecrow moved towards me as soon as I thought I had misdeemed it. I screamed and started running like crazy. Just then, a scarecrow, or a man dressed as a scarecrow, rushed towards me with a sickle in his hand. He ran after me, making some weird sound. I shouted as I fled desperately.
What the hell is wrong with you?
The scarecrow kept chasing me and making that weird sound. It sounded like a language I couldn't understand. As I glanced back, the scarecrow swung a sickle at me. My legs gave way with fear. Thinking that I'd be ripped apart and killed if I was caught by him, I ran away. Fortunately, I soon managed to get out of the field. When I looked back, I couldn't see the scarecrow anymore. I didn't understand why he was standing there for so long, pretending to be a scarecrow. One more thing I remember was that when I glanced at his face as I ran away from him, he was laughing. It seemed as if he was truly enjoying it. At first, I thought it was just someone's nasty joke, but I could tell it wasn't when he swung his sickle at me. He was literally trying to kill me. I almost lost my neck. When I got out of there, I immediately called the police. Shortly after, when the police arrived at the scene, they found no scarecrows at all. However, they did find evidence of murder, such as unknown bloodstains and flesh in the field. They're continuing to search the field. What was the scarecrow that was running after me and the rest of the scarecrows doing there? I still have terrible thoughts about it to this day. Were the rest of the scarecrows the bodies of the people he killed? If I didn't get out of there, would I have become one of those scarecrows? Or were the scarecrows other murderers in disguise?
Do you believe that a wish comes true if you want something badly enough? At first, I didn't believe in that at all. Just wish? That's BS. My wishes never came true, no matter how much I wanted them to. But now, I do believe it. And you would believe me if you listened to the story I'm about to tell you. There was a man I loved the most in the world. I had wanted him for such a long time. I always watched him from a distance, and not once did he so much as gaze in my direction. Actually, he had a girlfriend, and he didn't like me. However, I wanted to become one with him, forever. So I prayed, every day desperately, to make him mine. Hiding next to his house, I watched him every night. I felt like I was with him when I saw him through the window. I tried to share a moment, like watching him eat, sleep, laugh, talk, or even just walk around. I was happy, but I couldn't make him mine, no matter how hard I tried. We just had nothing to do with each other. I prayed like crazy, day and night, for him to be mine, but it was futile. No matter how often I prayed, nothing changed. I ended up cursing the god for ignoring my invocations and lived in a state of constant frustration, thinking that my life would forever remain empty. Then one day, an idea suddenly came to me. This is it. I can finally make him mine. And soon, I decided to put my plan in motion. One late night, I snuck into his house and slammed his head with a big frying pan while he was asleep. He was rendered unconscious, and now I could lay down right next to him. I could smell his scent and hear his heartbeat and the sound of his breathing. I could feel his presence so vividly, laying there. That was the moment my dream came true. I knew I had done something wrong, yet I couldn't regret it, because this was the only thing I'd ever dreamt of in my life. And the man whom I wanted so badly was here, right next to me. I thought he may have suffered serious brain damage from the impact. Maybe he would be disabled. It didn't matter, as long as he remained by my side. My dream came true. Do you understand what I said before? Now I understand what so many people used to say. If you want something desperately enough, you can get it. Nothing is impossible. Now I can die without any regret. He is finally with me. However, my satisfaction was short-lived when I realized the cost of this moment would be my life as I knew it. Sooner or later, the police would surely catch me. I don't want to leave his side ever again. I lie next to him, rub a string around his neck and mine, and pull it. I'll just sleep with him forever.
Six months ago, I moved to my new home in a new city, and I'll keep it private for my privacy, and you'll see why later in the story. I met my new neighbor. The first impression of him was that he was very nice, funny, and a down-to-earth guy, but his behavior began to change after getting to know him. He's becoming a bit weird. Then I met his son. He was telling me that his father was threatening him with stupid things because he was playing in a neighborhood and he only liked for his son to play at his house. He seemed like a hovering parent that did not like his son to go anywhere or to have any type of freedom. My neighbor began to be mean to everyone that lived near us. It became very distant, as if he wanted us to probably get away from him. At least that's what I was assuming. One night, it was around 2 a.m. when I was awakened by screaming and arguing. I stayed in my bed and I covered my ears with my pillow, but my window was open because I liked the fresh air. The arguing continued, and all of a sudden it stopped. I heard grunting and something being dragged across some type of floor. I got tired of hearing the noise, so I decided to get up and close my window, which is actually facing my neighbor's house. I got up, and as I were getting ready to close my window, I looked up at my neighbor's house, and I saw something hanging through a window, so I took this video. I didn't know what this was, but the prior argument that I heard told me that that was a body hanging from the ceiling. I shut my window very quietly, and I called the cops, but I whispered while I was on the phone with them. I don't know why, and at that point I didn't want to know why that happened. The person that he was arguing with was one of his son's friend's father. They were arguing over something my neighbor said to his son's friend. The police eventually came and they arrested him. I told them not to come over here so I didn't have to make a report, so I went down to the station. My neighbor has already been through trial, and he actually received a death sentence, but I don't want to give too much information because it'll bring up who I am.
This is the story of my friend Paul. He's an ordinary man in his mid-20s, but he's never been normal. He's been rejected by women all his life and never had a date with a girl before. Although he never gave up, he was never popular with the ladies. I felt kind of sorry for him. He would complain every day. Women are weird. They don't even know what's important. They need to find a man like me, but whatever. They don't realize that. He then started meeting women using some kind of app. Of course, he couldn't continue a relationship, but he would have a date at least once or twice a week. He finally ended up getting a girlfriend. At first, I thought he was joking. One day, I came to his house to visit him. But when I reached the front door of his house, I heard someone screaming. It was Paul.
Fuck! Why don't you love me? Love me! You're my girlfriend! You have to love me! I'll kill you!
I could hear him cursing frantically, and there was the sound of something bumping and falling. I froze for a moment. Should I just go back home? After thinking for a moment, I called Paul. He spoke calmly and said that it was all right to come in. When I entered the house, I could see Paul was alone. His house was a mess with all the furniture broken down, and blood was dripping from his hands. His girlfriend was nowhere to be seen. I asked him where she was, and he replied, "She's gone now." I tried to say what I heard outside, but then just shut my mouth. He explained that he was just upset and broke the furniture himself. I wanted to inquire more, but I was afraid that things would get worse, so I just shrugged it off. Since that day, I hadn't been able to reach Paul. I had no way of knowing what he was doing. He never seemed to come outside recently. A few days later, I heard a sudden but familiar yelling voice while walking on the street in my neighborhood. I looked where the sound came from, and there was Paul.
Why don't any of you love me? Why? I'll kill you all!
He cried and ran into women on the street. People around him were trying to stop him. I could see women running away in the chaos. And Paul, he just looked like hell. As time passed, I heard his girlfriend went missing. However, he claimed that he didn't do anything to her. He insisted that he's innocent. On top of that, no evidence was ever found. However, I still know the truth in my heart. I know he could be the one who made her go missing. I just don't know what to do. Above all things, there was no conclusive evidence that he murdered her. And, of course, it may be that he's not the real criminal. The case remains unsolved, and the cops still haven't spotted him as the culprit.
Yeah, the owner just up and vanished. Couldn't tell you why. Here.
The man took the keys and welcomed his new home. After the old owner disappeared, leaving his home and belongings behind in ruins, the colonial property became a bargain sale on the market. The man entered the renovated two-story home and began unpacking his things. Everything was fine until that day. A month later, he hears something.
Les!
Hello? Who's there?
The man stops on his stairs and looks around.
Avas!
He looks down at the steps, getting prone to listen closer.
Save us!
His heart stops and he jolts up. What he heard was a child's voice from below the steps.
I'll get you out of there! Just wait one second!
He runs upstairs to his room to find his tools.
Ease, please!
He hears more from below his feet.
What the... But how's that...
Sure enough, he hears a child begging from beneath his bedroom floor, despite the lack of any space beneath it. He finds a big hammer.
Stand back!
He shouts, driving the hammer into the floorboards. Prying the hammer from the hole, he dropped to the floor and started to look through it. However, he couldn't see anything, only darkness. So he shined a flashlight into the hole. Just then, he saw an eye peeking through the hole. It soon disappeared and a mouth moved to replace it. Shrieking, he fell back.
Get us out of here, sir! It's so dark! Find the exit!
In search of a trap door, his hammer leaves 20 more holes behind.
Help us! Help us escape! Please!
The hammer hit something solid. So he pried apart the floorboards. It was a metal door. He opened it and shined the flashlight down, but the light barely penetrated the darkness, so he got to his knees and reached down into the hole.
Grab on! I'll pull you kids out of there!
He feels a hand, then two, then ten. Before he can speak, he's yanked hard onto the floor, his face pressed against it. When he struggled to pull his arm out, his right eye over a hole saw another mouth appear under the hole, with pink lips smiling. It was giggling, then licked his eye. His arm started throbbing in pain. When he managed to rip his arm away from the hole and got up, he could see the bite marks on his skin.
What's wrong with you? What are you trying to do?
Cacophonous giggles erupted from the hole. He had enough. He started off, leaving to find someone else to help. Then, an arm suddenly broke through the floor and grabbed his ankle. Screaming, he shook it loose and started running, but dozens more arms tried to grab after him as he barreled downstairs. He slipped through them and finally reached the door. All of a sudden, the ceiling started splitting, and the giggling returned as eyes and mouths appeared in the cracks. He fleed out the door and never came back. A month later, a woman came to the house.
So yeah, another disappeared, just like the prior owner. Here you go, ma'am.
She took the keys and welcomed her new home.
I've never had the best of luck with guys. I appear to have poor taste when it comes to dating. After separating for good from my kid's father after 5 years, I was ready to just be myself. About 3 months of being a single mother, my neighbor approached me stating that a friend of his, Steve, would like to meet me. It didn't take long before he charmed his way into my life. The first 6 months were amazing, but he began to drink more and more, and each time he would get extremely agitated. He would start fights with random people, and even some of our friends. Slowly, our friends would stop coming around, knowing how Steve got when he drank. This, however, did not stop him from drinking. But now all the anger was aimed at me. It took roughly 6 to 8 months of buildup, from name-calling and shoving, to punching and choking. Suddenly, this became a very abusive relationship. One time, I escaped out of the bathroom window. He later found me by beating up a friend of mine until he told him where I was. Steve began stripping all of my clothes off in a drunken rage while laughing at me and challenging me to go ahead and try to escape while I was naked. The last night of abuse was by far the worst. Before Steve started drinking that night, I told him that my son, 3 years old, was not feeling very well, and I was going to stay with him as he fell asleep. My plan was to spend the night with my son. At around 2:30 in the morning, I heard the bedroom door open. I lied there pretending to be asleep. Several seconds went by. I held my breath as tears began to form in my eyes. When I suddenly felt his hand on top of my head, he grabbed my hair and yanked me out of bed, whispering in my ear, "I know you're avoiding me." Once in the living room, he threw me on the floor, then accused me of trying to leave him, and demanded to know why. Before I could answer, he angrily came to the conclusion that it was another man. "I swear to God, if I catch you with another man, I'll kill you and him." He was obviously more drunk than normal. He punched and kicked me a couple of times, and I fell to the floor. I started to crawl to my son's room, and he slowly came from behind me, asking, "Where do you think you're going?" He then walked in front of me, kneeled down, and said, "You stay right there or I'm gonna hurt you real bad." He then sat on the couch and watched me as I sobbed on the floor. After about 30 minutes, it appeared that he passed out on the couch. I decided that this was my chance to escape. I put on an oversized shirt, picked up my son, and slowly crept by him. He suddenly woke up and grabbed my leg and said, "Where are you going?" I stammered out that I was going into the kitchen with my son to get him a drink. He then angrily replied, "Hurry up." As soon as I entered the kitchen, I ran out of the front door with no pants on, no shoes, and no purse. I carried my son all the way to the police station. which was thankfully only a few blocks away. After hours, the way the police station is set up is that you go into a room and press a button and talk to someone on the intercom. I ran in and put my back to the wall and pushed the button behind me as I slowly slid down into a sitting position while holding on to my son, waiting for Steve to burst through the door at any second. I remembered thinking if I was going to be beaten, at least it would be on camera. On the speaker, I heard, "How can I help you?" All I could do was cry. I couldn't even get a word out of my mouth. I didn't know how to explain. Two officers came out to assist me. A female officer took my son and got him some food, and I went with the male officer to make a report, and he gave me a blanket. After 15 minutes, I heard Steve screaming my name as they brought him down the hallway. I held my breath as if he knew I was behind the door. 30 minutes later, an officer came back with a sergeant. At first, I thought they were going to tell me to go back home and gather my belongings while Steve was being held in custody. Instead, they asked me more questions about his anger issues and if there had been any previous fights. I explained to them Steve's alcohol problem and how he had become increasingly more abusive. They then showed me a list in Steve's handwriting detailing how he would dismember my body in a good spot where I would be buried without being found. He also had possible dates written down, with past dates crossed out. I couldn't breathe when I read this, and by this point tears were streaming down my face. I looked at the cop and asked, "What does this mean?" He looked back at me and said, "It means you're lucky." Steve was charged with attempted murder, kidnapping, and assault. I left back home to Arizona before the trial started, but gave a detailed statement before I left. Steve, of course, pled not guilty, but in the end, he received 2 years in prison. Just before I left for Arizona, I received a letter from Steve. It simply read, "It's not over. You'll always be mine."
"Mommy, is dinner ready? I'm hungry."
"It will be ready in a minute, sweetie. I'm making your favorite dish, meat pies."
"Yay, meat pies."
"Why don't you set the table while I get the pies out of the oven?"
"Okay."
"How does that taste, sweetie?"
"It's good, but the stuffing still tastes funny."
"I told you, it's a new recipe that I'm trying. Now finish your dish, and let's get you to bed."
"Okay, Mommy." "Mommy, when will Daddy come home?"
"Don't worry, honey. Daddy will come home in a few days."
"But you said that last week."
"Don't worry, sweetie. Now, sleep."
"Okay. Good night, Mommy."
"Good night, sweetie. Love you." February 11th, 2025. The meat portions are getting smaller and smaller each day, and Daisy has been bombarding me with questions about her daddy. I can't hide the truth anymore. I can't forget what happened. It has been 4 weeks since the incident. Well, everything is still in lockdown mode. I haven't seen anyone on the streets either. The first 2 weeks were hellish for us. We ran out of food. We had enough to feed Daisy, but not enough for us. I couldn't handle the hunger anymore. It grew day by day. And then on the third week, I couldn't think straight. And I had done it. I never knew human meat would taste like fully matured veal. I even made Daisy's favorite dish, meat pies. I can't think of anything else but the texture and taste of it. And the hunger is still growing. I wonder what Daisy would taste.
About 4 a.m., I was sitting in my living room watching YouTube on my TV. I was currently watching a horror story YouTube channel we all know very well. All of a sudden, my TV cut off for no reason. When I looked around, I realized that the whole electricity went out in general. "Damn it," I said out loud, wondering what's going on. Let me pause the story by saying that I live in an extremely rural area. Our neighbors are so far away that you can go outside and do basically anything without getting caught. I needed to pee, so I thought I would step outside and check our electricity meter and use the bathroom in the backyard while I was there. However, I couldn't make it to the backyard before encountering a weird guy I'd never seen before.
"Hey, is your power out too?"
he said. I looked at him and replied with a yes as he grinned and said that his had been out for a while. To be honest, this was really weird as I know pretty much everyone around here and I never met him on any other occasion. I told him I was going to the store across the bridge from my house to get some snacks. He then said,
"Hey, save your money. I've got plenty of snacks."
Since I didn't have a job at the time, I was extremely tight on money. I asked him what all he had, and he said he had some meat-based snacks. I usually don't take stuff from strangers, but I doubt I would have even had enough money to get a 50-cent can of sausages at that time. I certainly didn't have a full dollar at that point. Thinking that it's probably some kind of beef jerky, I accepted and asked him where he lived. He said that he lived on top of the hill across the road from my house.
"Follow me. We can hang out for a while."
I don't know why I did this, but this may very well be the most stupid decision I've ever made. I thought it was a little strange as I knew there were no houses on that hill, but I didn't really care. I thought maybe he was just horrible at directions. When we got to the top of the hill, I saw a small shelter made of nothing but sticks, and the whole area smelled like rotten meat. I instantly felt sick to my stomach. The guy pulled out a plastic freezer bag from his old dirty backpack and said it was already steamed so I could eat it straight from the pack. I thought I would know what kind of meat it was if I smelled it. I opened up the pack and was hit by that scent of rotten meat again. It was at least 20 times stronger than before. I threw up right there on the ground and dropped the backpack.
"Ugh, what the hell is that?"
I asked him, trying not to vomit again.
"It's a special type of meat some people would kill for."
It was his response, and the red flags were raised in my mind just then. "No, no, no," I said with tears in my eyes.
"Oh, but yes,"
he said. He began laughing maniacally. I immediately grabbed the package and ran into a dark place in the woods on the hillside, knowing he wouldn't be able to find me. I then called 911 and gave them my location. They said they would be there soon. Within minutes, a few cops arrived near my house. I sprinted towards them and showed them the package, explaining what just happened. One of the cops vomited as he looked at the package. At first, I didn't understand why, until I looked at it in the light, where I could finally see what was causing that horrible smell. It was the skinless meat of someone's face. They took the package for examination and said they would let me know what they found out. It's been 3 weeks now, and they haven't gotten in touch with me. I hope they find out whose face that was and catch that sick cannibalistic bastard. But most of all, I hope I never see that man ever again. I lived in the countryside until I was 16. My neighborhood was a small town. I lived with my uncle and grandmother. This is a horror story I experienced at that time. Almost 10 years later, the memory hasn't faded. When I was about 15 years old, my grandmother held my hand one day and said, "If some girl begs you to help her at night, do not help her. You have to ignore it and run away." It was a very famous rumor in this town. I thought it was just a story made up by somebody like any other ghost story, so I didn't really care about it back then. Actually, everyone in the neighborhood knew this story. If you hear a girl's voice at night, you must run, or you'll die. It was an obvious story. Then one night, I was out playing outside with my friends, and it suddenly got dark. Man, Grandma's gonna be pissed. I started walking home in a hurry, but the way home wasn't close. It soon became dark outside, and I was walking alone on an empty road. I began to get a little scared, so I purposely hurried up, humming to myself to calm down. Then, I heard a girl's voice in the forest next to the road.
Help me.
I felt a chill run down my spine. As soon as I thought I heard it wrong, I heard the voice once again.
It hurts.
Although it was a really small voice, I could tell for sure it was the voice of a girl. I looked where the voice came from, but all I could see was the dark forest. But then I saw something behind a tree. Its appearance in the dark began to become clearer. There was a little girl lying behind the tree. I was extremely taken aback. Thinking that she might have been hurt, I tried to approach her. However, I immediately recalled what my grandmother had told me. With a feeling of wariness, I stayed on the spot and stared at her. Then, the girl moved slightly and said once again,
"Is anybody there?"
I couldn't see her clearly in the dark, but something was unnatural. It didn't feel right. I moved slowly to escape from the spot. I heard her voice again and again, but I didn't get any closer. As I kept walking to the side, I could see the back of the tree. She wasn't lying down. Someone was hiding behind the tree, holding her up and supporting her body. Her body was lone. I couldn't tell whether she was dead or alive. Then, my heart dropped. I made eye contact with the man who was hiding behind the tree. He suddenly jumped out of the forest and started running towards me like crazy.
Help this poor girl!
It was the same girl's voice that I had just heard before. Screaming, I started to run away.
Ah!
This time, I heard the man in a deep voice.
Crap, he didn't fall for it.
I felt the fear of death and my whole life flash before my eyes. Just then, I saw a flashlight in front of me and realized what it was shortly afterward. My uncle came looking for me on his bike. My God, I'm alive. Thinking this, I burst out crying. I ran to my uncle, and when I looked back, the man was gone. I told my uncle and grandmother everything I saw, and we soon called the police. Police began searching for him, believing that he was involved in several disappearances in the town. But they failed to find him. I still can't forget the voice I heard that night. I probably wouldn't be here right now if I wasn't so lucky. Always be careful of the stranger's voice.
This incident took place when I was 20 years old. Next door to my house lived a man who only had one arm. My dad said he was a very good doctor, but that he'd lost one of his arms in an accident. Whenever I ran into him, he smiled abnormally brightly and shook his remaining arm. I felt sorry for him, but on the other hand, his unnatural expression and gestures sometimes gave me the goosebumps. He lived alone and always smelled bad. At first I thought it could have been because it was hard to take a bath with one arm, but the stench just got worse and worse as the days went by. One night, I heard loud noises coming from his house. It sounded as though he was fighting with someone. I could hear screaming, things breaking, and other unnerving sounds. A little while after, all that racket stopped. He came over to my house to apologize for all the noise and handed me a steak. I have to admit, the steak looked delicious, but I had to hold onto my nose because of his own stench. He then looked me over with a strange glance and smiled. I didn't know the meaning of that expression until a bit later. After all, aside from the noise, it was just a normal day, right? When I came to and opened my eyes, I was lying on the floor in a room that looked like a basement. My head hurt severely. When I touched it, my hair felt wet. I looked at my hand and there was blood all over it. Had I been hit over the head by someone? I tried to remember. After thinking about it for a long time, it started to come back to me.
The doctor had come over to my house and handed me a steak. Then he had looked past me into the house and said,
"So, is there no one at home?"
I was home alone that night because my parents were getting home late. So I replied, "Yes." As soon as I tried to close the door, he had pulled something out from behind his back and hit me on the head. Hard. I must have fainted, and now I had been kidnapped by him and locked up in the basement of his house. Then I noticed the smell. It was the same terrible stench that always followed the doctor. It hung in the air so fully that I just knew the source had to be close by. I looked around slowly. There were many things and machines that seemed to be used for some kinds of experiments. I turned my eyes towards where the smell was the strongest. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. A dead body lying on the floor. No, two dead bodies, each one missing an arm. I covered my mouth to hold back a scream. My hands were shaking. Just then, I heard a squeaking sound, followed by footsteps. The doctor was coming down the stairs into the basement. Quickly, I laid back down and stayed as still as I could, pretending to still be unconscious. Opening my eyes just barely, I could see the doctor heading towards the desk, humming to himself. On it, there lay two severed arms. He put one of them up to his stump and stepped in front of a mirror to look at himself, as if he was trying on clothes at the store. I couldn't breathe at all. After trying on both of the arms, he put them away, turned around, and started approaching me. He held my arm up to his stump. Then he pulled out a pen and started drawing a line around my arm. I had to do something to survive. When he turned his back to find some tools, I kicked him as hard as I could. He fell to the floor, and I managed to escape. When I was finally safely home, I immediately called the police. They arrived fast and arrested him. It turns out, he wasn't a doctor at all, but a crazy man who believed himself to be one, and also thought that he could attach another person's arm onto his own stump to replace the one he was missing. The trauma of this incident has left me with the tendency of folding my hands behind my back. I don't shake hands with anyone out of fear that my arm might be taken by someone else.
To the woman at the bar last night who noticed my body language, thank you. You couldn't have known the specifics. Maybe the guy that was being aggressive with me was my boyfriend, and we were just having a fight. Maybe you were afraid to get involved in a stranger's business, but you saw my nervous, intimidated body language, and you acted. There were couples and groups everywhere, but it took you, another girl alone at the bar, to recognize my struggle and act. We made eye contact. I was twisting my body away from the man's touchy hands and pleaded with my eyes. The look you gave me back was more than clear. You understood exactly what was happening to me. You'd probably been through it yourself. I can see you coming over and calling me by a generic term instead of a random name. "Hey, girl! It's been such a long time," you said, extending your arms and a lifeline. You wrapped your arms around me. It was a different sort of stranger's touch from the man's hand on my knee. I squealed like we were long-lost best friends, and I asked you what you were doing here. I remember the dull ache in my stomach when I heard you say that you were celebrating getting your master's in marine biology. Once upon a time, long before Rob and I ran these schemes in dirty bars, I had been a little girl that wanted to be a marine biologist. Oh well, that was literally a lifetime ago. Oh my god! Congrats, girl! I yelled at you violently and asked if you wanted to dance. "Of course," you replied, returning my vigor like I had loaned it to you. While we were heading out to the dance floor, I thought long and hard about giving Rob a signal. Your interest in marine biology made me feel guilty for a moment, but I ultimately took it as a sign that you were just my type. That you would taste wonderful. Only God knows how hungry I was. So, we started dancing, leaving behind Rob at the table. He hunkered off, pretending to be dejected. Nobody noticed him pass by where you had been sitting before, and nobody noticed him pour a small vial of liquid into your drink. Well, to the woman at the bar last night who noticed my body language, thank you for being so gullible.
Let me give you some background before I begin my story. This took place in the summer of 2014. I'm a female who was 22, turning 23 that fall. I don't want to share my location, so I'll be making some minor changes for privacy reasons. I live in a small college town. I've lived there my whole life, and I've graduated from there. There's a lot of history in this little town, but unfortunately we do have a drug problem here. Other than that, we don't get a whole lot of crazy around our small town. I worked at a gas station that was owned by a family member. My husband and I worked opposite shifts. I was the early bird, so I would work the morning shift. I would get up around 3:30, 4 o'clock, and open the store by 5. I was never worried about walking out to my car in the dark because I grew up living in the countryside outside of town. I loved being outside, even when it was dark. I used to lie in the grass and look up at the stars. When my friends would come over, we would always play Ghost in the Graveyard at night and did your typical teenager stuff during dark hours. Just messing around and having a little fun. We owned about 4 acres of land, and no one ever bothered us. So I was used to being outside in the dark with no fear at all, which I'm not too fond of because I was so used to being in an open space, and I was never really a city girl, even to this day. Now that you've got some background, let's get into the story. Now this is going to be a two-part story, so bear with me, because both of these incidents occurred very close to each other. As I mentioned before, it was the summer of 2014. I was getting ready for work like I usually did. When I got into my car, I started pulling out of my apartment's driveway. I then noticed a man walking down the road, pulling a suitcase behind him. As I got closer, I began to wonder why someone would be walking down the street pulling a suitcase at 4:40 in the morning. I thought about pulling up next to him and rolling down my window to ask him if he needed me to call the police or something, but I was suspicious. I grew up being told not to talk to strangers or to pick up hitchhikers, so there was no way that I was going to let a stranger into my car. But I'm also a nice person, and I'm always willing to help in any way that I can. But I wouldn't do something that could put my life in danger. When I pulled out of the driveway, the man then started walking right towards my vehicle. I remembered losing my nerve and took off down the street. I looked into my rearview mirror to see him just standing there watching me. I knew something was off about this person, and I was also thankful that I didn't offer to help him. Some of you might think, "Oh, you're just over-exaggerating." But come on, why would this man come right at my vehicle? And what the hell was he doing walking with a suitcase in the middle of the street at 4 o'clock in the morning? Once I reached my work, I called the police and reported it. I told them that I was just a concerned citizen, and I have been living in this neighborhood for the past 4 years, and I had never seen this man before. The police told me that they would send a car out to patrol the area. Hours went by, and I didn't hear anything from them. So I decided to call them back and inquire if they found anything. They told me that there was no trace of the man. So I just brushed it off and went about my day. I later mentioned it to my husband after my shift. And he told me that it was probably someone returning home from the airport or something. But the nearest airport is about an hour's drive away. My husband thought I was just overreacting about the whole thing. A few weeks later, I was talking to one of my customers and brought up this incident. It's a small town and everyone talks to everyone around here. As soon as I mentioned the man with the suitcase, my customer looked like he cracked his pants. He then started telling me that the police had recently discovered bodies in suitcases in our county. All the hairs on the back of my neck stood straight up, and my heart began to pound out of my chest. My customer asked me if I remembered what he looked like, but I didn't really get a good look at him. I'm not 100% sure if the man that I saw was the suitcase killer, but regardless, I'm glad I didn't stop to help that man. A couple of months later, I was again getting ready for work. I headed out of the back door of my apartment. My husband and I lived at the end of the hallway, so I figured I would just park my car close to the back door because I thought it would be easier than going all the way down the hallway. Plus, a lot of the front parking spots are always taken. When you go out of the back door, there are these huge pine trees lining a cement pathway that guides you to the back parking lot. It was still dark out, and the moment that I opened the back door, straight ahead was the dark figure of a large man running straight towards me. I didn't hesitate, and I slammed the door shut and rushed back into my apartment. My heart was pounding violently inside my chest. I was in full-on flight mode. I had never run so fast in my life. The moment that I reached the bedroom, my husband literally sat straight up and asked me if I was all right. After I explained to him what was going on, he stood up from the bed and headed to our door to look through the peephole to see if there was anyone in the hallway. He saw nothing, so he opened the door a crack and started looking around, but there was no one there. I was still shaking, even when my husband walked me out to my car. I'm lucky to have such a great guy for a husband. Later that day, when my husband arrived at the gas station for a shift, he told me from now on to park in the front where the lights were. The same week, I ended up buying some pepper spray just in case I needed it in the future. It's been about 7 years, and I still haven't used it, thank God. But I want to warn you all, even though you feel like you're safe in your own neighborhood, you still have to take precautions. Make sure that you park in well-lit areas if you're going to work very early like me. Always have a can of pepper spray or some sort of protection. You need to be aware of your surroundings, because you never know if there's someone hiding in the shadows, waiting for you to let your guard down. There are a lot of freaks roaming the streets, and you have to be careful out there. And if something doesn't feel right, follow your gut.
One rainy night, 3 years ago, I was driving on a quiet road with no other cars. Despite of the heavy rain, I managed to spot a soaked-up man standing at the side of the road. His presence was strange. There was no place for pedestrians anywhere nearby. I thought that something may have happened to him, so I stopped the car. My headlights lit him up slightly. He seemed to be grinning widely. I was surprised as my initial assumption had been that something was wrong. But if that was the case, why would he be laughing like that? I lowered my window, only a little, feeling unsure. The man approached. When he got closer, and I got a better look at his face, my heart dropped. He wasn't smiling. He had no upper lip at all, as if it had been cut off. I could see his eyes were red. I wasn't sure if all the water running down his face was rain. There were tears mixed in. I spoke in a trembling voice. Sir, do you need any help? Then he suddenly screamed and rushed at me. You should be like me! He took out his knife and stuck it through the small opening in the window, madly trying to force it down further. I hurriedly closed the window and started the car, then hit the gas. I could see him chasing me like crazy from the rearview mirror. I floored it with all my might. Got the heck out of there. I don't even remember exactly how I got home, and my trembling heart wouldn't calm down until morning. Even after all these years, I tremble whenever I think about that night. I don't have any idea what that man's story could have been, what kind of a person he was, or if he was even human. But one thing is for sure. I will never drive on that road again.
In my senior year of college, me and my boyfriend at the time lived in an off-campus apartment on the third floor of this big old townhouse. In the mudroom/closet area right by the door was where we kept our cat's litter box. Now, most people can tell you that unless it's right after your cat uses the box, it doesn't smell like poop. Usually just the cat litter smell. Clay, Febreze, whatever it is. So for about a week, I noticed it smelled like death in that little corner. And I tore the area apart and the rest of the apartment looking for rogue turds, but found absolutely nothing. Then right in the middle of the mystery stink ordeal, I had to leave for a week to go on a work trip. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't a welcome break from what was massively a disgusting little problem. And I quite openly hoped that my boyfriend might get the whole thing fixed before my return. But to my horror, it only got worse, with my boyfriend texting me one night with the bad news that the smell seemed to have spread into the hallway outside. I felt bad for him, but there was nothing much I could do other than advise him to just call the landlord and see what she could make out of it. He says okay, and he'll call her in the morning and keeps me updated on everything that happens. The next morning, I'm getting texts off of him like every 20 minutes, stuff like, just called landlady and she's on her way. Then I get stuff like, she thinks it's coming from another apartment. Then, okay, it's definitely coming from another apartment, which I was kind of relieved about, but oh my god, was that jumping the gun, because things were about to get way, way worse. The last text I get is, she just called the cops. I reply with, please don't tell me someone died next door to us. Then my boyfriend starts typing, but then stops. I go into full panic mode, trying to work out what it might be, because I can't face the thought that our neighbor actually died. And we were living next to a corpse for like weeks, and partially because we were the jerks and didn't check on her. Then after about an hour, my worst fears are confirmed. The landlady gave some cop permission to bust the door down, and when he did, my boyfriend said he and the landlady literally ran from the site that greeted them. Our neighbor's dead body was lying there, face down in the hallway, with one arm out like they were reaching for the door when they fell. That piece of hallway ran perfectly adjacent to our mudroom, where we keep the cat's litter tray, which is why it smelled the worst there and out in the hallway. The whole time I've been thinking to myself, frickin' cat, shaking my head and scrubbing the floor, and there had been a dead body just on the other side of the wall, not even 2 or 3 feet away. We always keep up with our neighbors now, even if they're more than capable of looking after themselves. Having that network, that kind of community, you don't realize how important it is until it's far too late.
It all started when I was 8 years old and we had just moved to Michigan. One night, my older brother and I were playing video games on our old PlayStation 1. In the middle of our session, I got a little bit thirsty and headed to the kitchen to get something to drink. When I was walking to the fridge, I noticed this odd, small shape in the woods outside, but I figured it was just a tree stump and thought nothing further of it. So I grabbed my drink and went back to play with my brother until bedtime. In the middle of the night, though, I woke up to the sound of crunching leaves. The little 8-year-old me was immediately scared. I remember my heart was pounding so fast. I got out of bed, pulled aside the curtain, and stared into the woods. But all I could see was the same shape that I'd seen earlier that night. Eventually, I managed to calm myself down and went back to bed. The next morning when I woke up, I thought that I'd probably just had a bad dream. I'd soon learn just how wrong I was. I went downstairs for breakfast and poured myself a big bowl of cereal. But just when I was about to take the first bite, I suddenly felt sick. I could feel the hot puddle of drool in my mouth and my stomach twisted like it'd been tied into a knot. I rushed to the bathroom. When I threw up, all I could see were slimy and green things. I hadn't eaten anything bad. In fact, I had barely eaten the day before. There was nothing I could think of that could be causing me to retch like this. My mother walked in to help me clean up and then took me to see a doctor. The doctor ran a couple of tests on me, but the results showed nothing out of the ordinary. He told us to just wait a couple of more days and see if it would pass. Luckily, it did. The following few months were calm and free of any strange incidents. Then my cousin came over. We were playing on the trampoline in the backyard when I felt sick again. This time it was a bit different though. I didn't throw up. I just felt really sick and anxious. I went to my mother and told her that I wasn't feeling well, and she said that I probably just needed to eat something to feel better. Eventually my cousin went home, and the day was perfectly normal again, until I went to bed. I woke up in the middle of the night to the sound of crunching leaves. I looked towards the window, and what I saw made my stomach drop. It was a woman's figure. I couldn't move at all, and my chest and right arm were hurting so badly. I somehow managed to finally find my voice and screamed as loud as I could. My parents burst into the room. My mother called 911, while my father stayed with me, trying to comfort me. At that point, I think I just fainted. When I opened my eyes again, I was lying in a hospital bed. I ended up staying for 2 more days, until I had properly recovered. Then years passed, and that strange woman didn't appear again. Around the time I turned 16, my family had to move to New York due to my father's job. On the day we were supposed to leave Michigan, I was finishing packing up my room. All of a sudden, I felt that strange wave of nervousness course through my body again. I immediately spun toward the window and froze. There she was, the same woman I had seen years ago. She was standing there in a long torn-up dress in the very same spot and looking directly at me. Except, in the daylight, I could see her face better. She had no hair and was missing both eyes. Just like when I was 8, I couldn't breathe or move at all. I heard my mom calling my name, but I couldn't answer. Shortly after, she knocked on my door. As soon as she entered and saw me having a seizure on the floor, she screamed. Then, something really strange happened. When my father ran in, having heard my mother scream, she was looking out the window and said to him, "Don't call the cops. She just wants to play. Give her a chance." My mother stopped caring about me and kept repeating the same phrase over and over again. I thought she had gone crazy. But by the time the police arrived at the house, she had stopped repeating the words and was like my usual mom again. I was rushed to the emergency room and got an MRI to see if I had brain damage or something. But they told me that my brain looks perfectly healthy. We moved, and I thought that that would be the end of all that. A few years later in New York, I had found a job at a local store. I was just about finished with my night shift, and about to lock the front door, when I suddenly felt like someone was watching me. I turned around and the woman with no eyes was standing right there. It had to be a nightmare. It just had to be. I passed out almost immediately. I didn't even have time to scream. When I woke up again, I could see flashing red and blue lights. The emergency technician said that my heart had stopped beating for about 60 seconds. The woman with no eyes hasn't appeared since then. Maybe she thinks that she finally managed to kill me. Yet, I'm still alive.
To give some background information, this event occurred a little over a year ago, and I still haven't been able to even begin to get over it. I'm a 22-year-old 5'4 female, and at the time I was 21. My family and I had recently moved to a new town that was a fair amount more rural than the town I had previously lived in, and our new house was a large ranch-style house with a basement. I was home from college, and my parents had left for the week to celebrate their wedding anniversary with their friend who lived several hours away. Before I continue, I'll give you a quick layout of the house so that you'll be able to imagine the setting. There were three doors which led into the house, one on the front porch, a sliding glass door on the back porch, and another door on the other side of the wall from my bedroom, which led into the garage and the basement. When you walk out of my bedroom and turn, you can see all the way across the house, kitchen, living room, dining area, to the door of my parents' bedroom, and the stairs leading up from the basement. It had been a few days since my parents left, and I hadn't had any problems. They had sent me a couple messages on Facebook, letting me know that they arrived to their friend's house safely and were having a good time. The day had gone well, and I was sure to check that I had locked all the doors of the house once the sun started to go down. It was about 11 p.m., and I was doing my nightly routine of laying in bed and messing around on the computer when I suddenly got this sinking feeling of dread. I felt as if I was being watched. It was summer, and we didn't have air conditioning, so I had a large box fan in the window blowing the cool night air into my stiflingly hot room. But once that feeling settled over me, I decided that I should remove the fan and close the window just in case. Once removing the fan, shutting and locking the window, and pulling down the curtain, I felt a bit better. However, I still couldn't shake the feeling of dread. I lay back in bed and tried to continue what I was doing, though I didn't put my headphones back on. After a few minutes, I began to hear something that sounded like light scratching. I sat still in bed, listening to the sound, trying to pinpoint what it was and if I recognized it at all. Our new house, although relatively close in distance to our neighbors, had a fair amount of forest around it, so I thought the scratching may have been an animal or someone's dog that got loose and wanted to come inside. After a few minutes, the scratching stopped, and everything returned to silence. I figured that I was probably right, and that it must have been an animal. My relief was short-lived. As soon after the scratching stopped, from the other side of the wall, I began to hear slow footsteps descending into the basement. This is when I realized that there was someone in my house. There was no way I could get out of the house without walking past the basement stairs. We didn't have a house phone, and at the time, I was in the process of getting a new cell phone because mine was broken beyond repair. I sat there for a few seconds wondering what the hell I should do. I knew that I would need to get out of the house as soon as possible, and that the more time I wasted, the worse it could be for me. I contemplated popping the screen out of my bedroom window and jumping out, but it was far enough off the ground that there was a good chance I would end up getting hurt if I did. Not to mention that if I jumped out the window and hurt myself, I wouldn't be able to run for help, and I would be right next to the door that whoever was in my house had gone through. So I decided to very carefully and quietly open my door and peek out around the corner, and if the coast was clear, I would make a dash for the front door and sprint to my neighbor's house. I very slowly opened my bedroom door, letting my eyes adjust to the darkness of the house before creeping around the corner and looking to see if it was safe to make a run for it. What I saw nearly made me vomit. As my eyes scanned the house, I noticed that something was off. I squinted hard as I looked over at the basement stairs and was able to make out the shape of a man. What made it worse, he wasn't just standing at the top of the stairs. He was crawling up them like some kind of nightmare creature. I quickly backed into my room again, shutting and locking the door as quietly as I could. I didn't think that he had seen me, but there was no way that I was going to make a run for it now. My only choice was to pop the screen and jump out the window. As I was unlocking and opening my window, I heard the handle to my bedroom door turn. Once the man realized that it was locked, in a sickeningly sweet, sing-song voice, he cooed, "I know you're in there." This was followed by a loud cackle, and what I can only imagine was him throwing himself at full force against my door. I ripped the screen out from the window and flung myself out. I landed wrong on my right foot, and I was sure that I had broken my ankle. But at the time, I couldn't think of anything other than getting as far away as possible. I got up and ran as fast as I could to my neighbor's house, knocking on their door in a panicked frenzy and ringing the bell over and over. I looked over at my house as I was yelling for my neighbors to let me in, and I swear, I could see the man standing at my window, waving at me. My neighbors finally opened the door after what felt like forever, and I managed to explain well enough what was going on for them to let me in and call the police. I stayed with them until the police arrived. The police searched my house and found that the lock to the basement had been picked and that the door to my bedroom was hanging off its hinges. They weren't able to find the man anywhere, and because I had only seen him for a split second in the dark, I couldn't provide them with a good description. Of course, I got into contact with my parents immediately, and they hurried home. The police took my statement and searched the area for the man, but of course they came up with nothing. After this event, my parents and I were sure to add deadbolt locks to the door leading into the basement and the door leading out of the basement to the rest of the house. They also helped me pay to get a new phone. What really bothers me about all of this is that nothing was stolen. There wasn't even any evidence that the guy had looked through anything while he was in my house. I used to take care of a mentally disabled man in a community protection program. He had to be kept away from people because of his sudden violent outbursts. His parents were rich and bought an old farmhouse on 10 acres or so, about 4 miles out of town, so that he could be away from the public and not forced into a psych ward. For 4 years, I worked there on a 56-hour shift, come in on Sunday evening and leave Wednesday afternoon. There were two of us on these shifts, and we were both supposed to be there the entire 56 hours, but because we were the most senior trainers on staff, we would take turns going home on one of the two nights we were scheduled. After 3 years of being in that house, I had become comfortable with it, despite it being so isolated and overall kind of creepy. I would always stay up and watch TV until around midnight. My client was always locked in his room at about 8 p.m. One night, about 12:15 a.m., I turned the TV off and pulled the covers over myself to try and get some sleep. There was one window in the staff room, and it faced the back of the property, and it was about 6 feet off the ground. I had just started drifting to sleep when I heard the most blood-curdling woman's scream from right outside the window. I popped up so fast that I nearly lost consciousness and had to steady myself in the doorway while the scream continued and then faded away. I grabbed a flashlight from the laundry room and threw open the back door, illuminating the area outside the window, and there was nothing. I ran along the perimeter of the house and saw nothing. I watched the sun come up the next morning, desperately glued to the TV, trying to distract myself from what had happened. All of the people I worked with were much older than me, and there was no good reason to play a prank like that in the middle of January in eastern Oregon. I'm sure there's an explanation, but it bothers me to this day. I went on a date with a guy from Craigslist. I was 17 years old at the time. I put an ad up looking to meet someone. I don't remember the details. A guy responded who lived close to me, and so I emailed him back and gave him my number. He was actually one of the only ones who responded without a creepy message. He said his name was John and that he was 26 years old. This guy, John, and I spoke for 2 days before meeting, and we met on a Friday night. We texted back and forth, and he asked if I was single. I said yes. He asked what kind of food I liked to eat, because he wanted to take me to a restaurant. I asked him a few questions about himself. He told me he still lived with his mother, but had the top floor to himself, and that he was a part-time model that made good money. Judging by his picture, him being a model was fairly believable. So on Friday night, John comes to pick me up. He drove a silver two-door car. He texted me and said that he was waiting outside. And after checking my hair and makeup one last time, I said goodbye to my parents, telling them I was heading out with friends, and then left. I got into John's car, and the first thing I noticed was that he looked exactly like his photo. He had pale skin with dark hair and dark eyes. He looked a little older in person, but he made up for it with a snappy fashion sense. He looked really cool. He was incredibly kind, and his body language and smile totally put me at ease. Yes, it's really stupid to go on a date from Craigslist, but surprisingly, this guy was normal. We chatted for a while as he started driving away from my hometown, towards the highway. He wanted to drive us into the city to go to dinner, which wasn't too far away, around a 25-minute journey. John started to reveal more details about himself to me on this journey. He told me he was embarrassed to tell me that he lived with his mother, that I might think bad of him, or not having his own place at his age. John got closer and closer to the highway, and I can't tell you what it was. I won't make it up because I don't remember, but it wasn't anything remotely creepy. I just felt put off by him. You know where you're on a date with someone, and you're not sure, and then they tell you something that's your biggest turnoff? It was that kind of situation. Again, he didn't say anything too creepy, just off-putting. As we're getting closer and closer to the turnoff, I tell this perfectly nice guy, "I'm really sorry. I don't feel like going to dinner anymore. I'm not feeling well." John's initial reaction was sympathy. "What's wrong? Are you okay? Is it my driving?" I told him I just didn't feel well. John then kept asking me, "What did I say? What did I do?" I told him it's not him, it's me. I wanted to go home because I felt ill. Then he said, "Okay, just let me drive you around for a bit before I take you back. I don't want to end the evening like this." I knew that without him driving me home, I'd have to walk over an hour, maybe more. So I told him that driving for a bit sounded like a fine idea. But instead of him turning around and going back towards my house, he veered off and started heading to the town I knew that he lived in. I should mention that it was pitch blackout, and the town where John lived was surrounded by dense woods. This isn't even worth mentioning if you take the highway and proper turnoffs to get there, but he decided he wanted to go via the back roads because it's more scenic, despite the fact I couldn't see a thing. John had gone from being incredibly talkative to almost completely silent. He kept driving further into the wooded area. A few times I'd ask him questions about himself to break the awkward silence. At one point, I put my hand on his knee affectionately, trying to regain the friendly, flirty banter that we had had before. He blanked me for the most part, occasionally answering in soft grunts or nods. It was like he was having a tantrum. John pulled into the parking lot for the forest. It was around 9 p.m., so naturally it was totally empty. He slowly kept driving, looking around for other cars, and then parked the car upright at the end, close to the woods. There was nobody else in the parking lot, and I hadn't even seen us pass other cars to get there. For 10 minutes he just sat there, staring into the darkness ahead, which was disturbing. I think I managed to make small talk for maybe 5 minutes, which is a long time when someone isn't talking back. Then I joined him in his silence. I was afraid of appearing fake. I didn't want him to think I was scared. So some time of silence goes past, and abruptly John gets out of the car, closes the door, and locks the car. I was stuck inside. His lights were on, so I could sort of see ahead. In front of the car was a field that maybe went on for about 20 feet, and then beyond that were trees and dense forest. To the left was the rest of the car park and the exit at the far end, and to the immediate right was more forest with a small path. John disappeared into the forest ahead. I tried the handle on the door. It would not open. I began to rationalize this. Maybe he accidentally locked the door. I was telling myself if he really wanted to do something, he would have stayed in the car. With no sight of John, I decided I needed to call someone. I looked around for my phone, and I couldn't find it. This was an old, silvery pay-as-you-go flip phone. I was confused that I couldn't find it because I had put it right next to me in the cup holder. After looking for it for a good few minutes, I became sure that he had taken it. Mind you, I didn't want to start rooting around his car, knowing he might be watching me. I didn't want him to catch on that I was freaking out. At that point, I started looking for my phone with only my eyes, instead of making it obvious. I was petrified this guy was watching me panic in the darkness. My eyes were darting all around the floor. Nothing. I looked up and squinted into the field and forest ahead. I saw him. John was standing about 10 feet from the car in that small field. He was standing and smiling. It wasn't a friendly smile. He looked terrifying. This was not the same guy that I got in the car with. I looked ahead and smiled back. I was still trying to act like his behavior was normal, like nothing he was doing was scary. Still smiling, his tongue began to protrude from his mouth. He stuck it out all the way. He began wagging his tongue up and down while maintaining eye contact with me. I felt myself trembling. I was trying to compose myself. Not taking his eyes off of me, and with his tongue still out, he started unzipping his pants, and then began to urinate in front of me while staring at me the whole time. This is the point I found it difficult to act like I was in on his behavior. I looked down at the floor, not wanting to watch what was in front of me. He didn't creep or slink back to the car. Instead, I hear his thundering steps and then a slam against the window. I guess at this point I was the luckiest person alive because another car pulled into the parking lot. I don't know what this did to John, but immediately he got back into the car and laughed at me, that normal laugh, and said, "So what music do you like? I'll put it on while I drive you home." And he did. He drove me all the way home. When he pulled up to my house, I went for the door, but it was still locked. "I want you to promise me something." I asked him what that was. "If you see me, if you ever see me after this, turn the other way. Act like you don't know me. If you see me with my family, don't you dare say a word. I don't expect to bump into you, but don't say anything." I agreed, and then I asked him, "Have you seen my phone?" He told me no. I guess my phone was a small sacrifice for surprisingly making it home okay. When I got inside my house, I said goodnight to my parents and went upstairs to my room and then turned on my computer. I wanted to gather as much information about the guy that I could. Back then, I used MSN Messenger, like AOL Instant Messenger. It logged in automatically whenever I started up my PC. Now, before I get to the final part of this story, it's important that you know this. One day before, I had been at my best friend's house. We had the kind of friendship where it was like, who could pick on the other the most? It was all good fun, and we mostly just made fun of each other and had a laugh. The day before, my friend had changed 2 contacts in my phone. She replaced the contact Mom with a guy that I had been texting back and forth with. I immediately knew she had done this because I saw the previous messages come up, but I didn't change the numbers back at the time, thinking that I would just do it later. So when I logged on to MSN Messenger, I had a ton of messages from this guy and a few from my best friend. When John had locked me in the car, he had taken my phone and texted Mom, which was actually this guy, "I'm sorry, but I decided to move out. I've met someone. Please don't look for me. I am happy being left alone." The guy knew that this was a big red flag. He responded and texted my phone back saying, "I don't think this is you. I know where you went and I'm calling the police." This was incredibly quick thinking for him as he had absolutely no idea where I was. I think that text saved my life that night. and it explains John's sudden change of behavior. If it wasn't the random car that pulled into the parking lot, it was that text. I was staying at a friend's house and woke up in the middle of the night to someone else in bed with us. I could see from the street lamp that my friend was turned away from me when I sat up, and that there was an unknown person there too. It was very dark, and I couldn't make out their facial features, so I really gently reached out and touched them. They appeared to be asleep, but for all I know, they were awake, with wide eyes, looking at me. I can't explain why I didn't scream or anything. I decided to lay down and not move, and if they did something that could have meant trouble, then I would react. I didn't sleep, and watched as this person eventually got up and walked out of the room, down the stairs, and out the front door. I went downstairs to make sure they had really left, and then locked the door. It really freaked me out that someone could welcome themselves into a home and just climb into bed with two girls. My friend slept through it all and doesn't truly believe that it happened. When I was a kid, barely a teenager, I frequently spent my Saturday nights babysitting my siblings. As the eldest of three, I assumed this responsibility with no pay or thanks to speak of. It was simply expected of me, one of my contributions to the family. I babysat so frequently because my parents needed it. They had had marriage problems in the past, and their counselor told them they should go on a weekly date. You know, revive the magic, rekindle the flame, all that good stuff. It sucked to be robbed of a weekend evening, but it wasn't much of a burden. My parents were happier than they'd been in a long time, and they both seemed genuinely excited for date night each week. I would have rather been doing other things, of course, but I'd seen my aunt and uncle go through a nasty divorce a few years back, and I desperately wanted my parents to stick together. And so it was on that night of December 3rd in the year 2006, I stood at the open front door of my secluded Colorado home, waving goodbye as my parents backed out of the icy driveway, wrapping my arms around my torso in response to the wintry mountain air. I entertained myself for a few brief moments by exhaling forcefully and watching my breath float away into nothing. And there was truly nothing around me. Not a car or a creature in sight. It wasn't long before I grew bored and turned back into the warm house, nose tingling from the chill. George and Kate were eating their dinner at the kitchen table. As I watched them, I couldn't help feeling like an only child. George, who was 3 years younger than me, was severely autistic and about as talkative as a bag of bricks. He only spoke when he really wanted something, and only then in the simplest of words, milk and sandwich, was code for peanut butter and jelly with the crust cut off, which he was presently devouring. Kate, meanwhile, was still a baby, just shy of 2 years old. The 9-year gap between them is glaring, but to this day, my parents swear to me that Kate wasn't an accident. Kind of like back in high school, when I swore to them, I had no idea how those magazines got under my mattress. But I digress. The kids finished dinner, and I set them up with their entertainment for the night. George in his room with the PlayStation 2, and Kate in her crib in front of Sesame Street. Myself, I ignited the basement fireplace, dimmed the overhead lights, and curled up with a book by the light of our Christmas tree. I read in perfect contentment for nearly an hour. Night had fallen by then, and the room had become toasty. I was beginning to doze off when I heard George's heavy footsteps descending the staircase. I sat upright and looked at him expectantly as he waddled into the room. "No more knocking," he said, his eyes looking at me in annoyance. I shook my head. "I'm not knocking," I said. "Is someone at the door?" George stared at me blankly. George, I said, more clearly this time, did someone knock on the door? No more knocking. He repeated, knocking on window. Knocking on window? I stood up, now wide awake. George, is someone knocking on your window? No more, he replied simply. I stood in silence for a moment, unsure of what to do. It was probably just one of my friends playing a trick on me, I thought. But being alone in a house that big makes you a little jumpy. My mind started to race through the situation. I was a 13-year-old boy in a nice house on the hilly outskirts of a Colorado mountain town. The streets were engulfed in trees, and there were no homes within a quarter mile of my own. Our road saw next to no traffic, and the police station was a good 15 minutes away. It was probably my friends, I thought. But what if it wasn't? Follow me, I told George, hand trembling slightly. I turned the knob and glanced up the staircase. It was dark up there. The only light came from Kate's bedroom. Kate. I sprinted up the stairs to her room, where she remained happily perched in her crib, squawking with delight as Elmo fiddled with his crayons. I breathed a sigh of relief, but still, my heart pounded in my chest. I made my way down the hall to George's room and stood tentatively at its door. Taking a deep breath, I gently pushed the door ajar, reaching for the light switch and thinking better of it. If this was the worst-case scenario, then I didn't want our mystery intruder outside to know where in the house I was. The only light in the room came from the video game paused screen. I listened for a moment, but heard nothing. I began to suspect that Georgie had simply imagined the knocking. I moved to the window and flicked up a blind to reveal nothing, just a landscape of freshly fallen snow backed by a quiet, lonely road. I watched the peaceful night, relieved, as the large flakes fell softly to the ground, my eyes trailing an individual fractal all the way to the footprints just beneath the window's frame. At first, I did not comprehend them. I just stared, transfixed, at the deep imprint in the snow. Shoes. A man's shoes. None of my friends wore that size. Of that I felt sure. I traced them backwards from the window to the sidewalk, from whence this intruder had evidently come. But where did they lead? It was a bright night. The moon shone proudly between the clouds. My eyes followed the steps across the front yard, but once they passed behind the giant pine tree, they disappeared. My heart leapt to my throat. Whoever had walked behind that tree was still there. In panic, I quickly backed away from the window. George sensed my fear and began to whimper. No, 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 shh, I muttered, desperate to keep him quiet. I flicked the television off and led George out of the room. I quickly pulled Kate from her crib, powered her TV down as well, and carried her down the stairs into the blackness. Can't see, George said, and Kate began to cry. I shushed her hurriedly as we descended. Once in the basement den, I unplugged the Christmas tree so that the only light in the room came from the embers of the dying fire. I sat George down on the couch and settled Kate into his arms. Sit right here, I directed, staring into his eyes. Don't move, do you understand? Do not move. I thought to myself, I need to call the police. I would have called my parents, but this was 10 years ago, and they didn't have cell phones. So I took the stairs quickly and quietly, tiptoeing to the phone hanging from the wall of our living room. I picked up the phone and dialed 911, but I heard nothing. Silence. I slammed it on the receiver and picked it up again. Again. Nothing. I think it was around this point that I started to cry. I couldn't help it. I was scared. I tried to calm myself down, telling myself that the storm had killed the phone line. But there wasn't much of a storm. The snow was steady, sure, but there wasn't even a breeze. Certainly nothing that could have disabled our phone. Tentatively, I walked into Kate's room and peeked out the window. My first glance was towards the tree, of course, where the footprints stopped, but now they continued. Sometime while I was herding my siblings downstairs, whoever was behind the tree had moved. I followed the footsteps across my frozen front yard to a man standing near the driveway. He was looking right at me. My breath stopped. I was frozen in place. This was not one of my friends. I had never seen this man before, but he was looking at me with an eerie blankness. He was wearing a black turtleneck and black slacks, a lone dark spot on a blanket of purest white as he stood in the snow. My eyes never left him, and his never left me. We stood still, silently staring for what seemed like an eternity. My heart throbbed in my chest, and I felt nauseous. For the first time, gazing into this man's eyes from afar, I began to consider the possibility of my death. I thought of my dad's brother, who was killed in an accident at age 11. Forever 11, never growing up, frozen in time, in the memories of all who knew him, as a soul of eternal youth. At this, the tears flowed freely once more. "Please don't hurt us," I begged in a sobbing whisper. I knew he could not hear me, but I could not help myself. Finally, he broke eye contact with me and looked toward the heavens, toward the gently falling snow. He was saying something, but what? I could not hear. I stared, transfixed, as he pulled a handful of dark powder from his pocket. Then, still gazing upward, still muttering to himself, he flung whatever it was to his feet. I desperately wanted to run to get my siblings, but I thought that to let this man out of my sight would be unconscionably foolish. No, better to keep an eye on him. The house was still locked. I had the upper hand. Besides, I could not bring myself to look away from the strained ritual unfolding before me. The man had removed his sweater and flung it carelessly to the ground behind him. He was no longer staring skyward, but his lips continued to move. I trained my eyes intently upon his mouth, trying with no success to read his words, when I saw something glint in the moonlight. It was a knife, a long, callous blade, which he had removed from his other pocket. It bore dark stains already. From what? I covered my mouth to hush a scream as the man, still muttering to himself, ran the edge of the blade along his pale, distended stomach. A thin red line appeared along his abdomen, and blood of the deepest shade began to dribble from the wound. The streams trickled down his belly and fell ungracefully upon the black powder at his feet. At this, the man stared skyward once more, face contorted in a gruesome smile. He was sobbing uncontrollably, and mucus ran freely from his nostrils, but he looked happy, beyond happy, elated. My stomach churned in revulsion. This man was in ecstasy. I watched, almost entranced by this bizarre unfolding, when the man's face changed suddenly. He looked directly at me once more, and his eyes appeared unhinged. Still clutching the knife, he began to sprint directly at my window. I took one look at the weapon this man brandished and instinctively fled the room. I slammed the door shut behind me and was halfway down the stairs when I heard the window shatter. The man screamed loudly in pain as I reached the basement. I locked the door behind me and ran to George and Kate. "No more screaming," George pleaded. "No, no more screaming," I agreed in hushed tones, stroking his hair in an effort to calm him down. Kate, meanwhile, seemed happy as a clam. I strained, listening intently. Is he inside the house? I still clung to some naive hope that he had injured himself on the glass and had retreated, or perhaps he had been weakened by a self-inflicted wound. Finally, I heard it, the subtle but unmistakable sound of footsteps upstairs. He was indeed inside the house, and by the sound of it, was trying to be quiet. I silently guided George and Kate into a storage closet and closed the door behind us, manipulating the handle to make as little noise as possible. We stayed there for about 5 minutes, listening to the ceiling creak threateningly above us. Then, I realized that we were not trapped. We still had a way out. I saw in my mind's eye a window well in the bathroom down the hall, the only access our basement had to the outside world. Almost as if on cue, a frustrated scream echoed from above, followed by a tremendous crash. He had pulled something to the ground, perhaps the entertainment stand, or maybe it was the hutch. "He's here!" the man shrieked hysterically. "How dare you hide from him?" To this day, I don't know who he was talking about, but it was at that moment, the moment I heard him begin to descend the stairs, that I made my move. Holding Kate in one arm and guiding George with the other, we began our flight down the hallway. As we reached the bathroom, I stared fixedly at the window near the ceiling. It would be a tight fit, but we could make it. I flung the window open, stood on the toilet, and placed Kate gently in the shallow window well. Then I stepped off and told George to get on. "Yucky, gross, no standing on toilet," he said, looking embarrassed. I heard the man fumble with the locked handle at the base of the stairs. Time was running out. I'm not proud of what I did next, but it was the only way I could think to get George to cooperate. I smacked my brother roughly across the face and grabbed him by the shirt with both hands. "George, get on the toilet now," I snarled at him, the first time I had ever done that. He began to wail in pain and surprise, but he did step onto the toilet at the same time. "Climb out the window," I directed in a harsh tone, and as he grabbed the ledge, I used all the strength I could muster to help push him up. Once, he almost slipped back down, almost, but he was stronger than I thought he was, and managed to pull himself back up. With both of my siblings safely in the window well, I climbed on the toilet one last time and gripped the edge of the windowsill. As I clambered out myself, I heard a crash. The man had broken down the basement door. With one last hoist, I pulled my legs up through the window and shut it quietly behind me. As I helped my siblings out of the well, I heard one last anguished shout from the man, muffled through the pane of glass. "Why are you hiding from him?" "Cold," screamed George as I led him barefoot through the snowy grass. In panic, I shushed him, but it was no use. He and Kate were both crying quite loudly by this point. My only hope was to get them as far away from the house as possible. I heard a distant crash from inside the house, and I quickened our pace. Feet numb, I sprinted through the yard to the sidewalk and practically had to drag George onto it. "Bathroom light on," he said pleadingly. He was obsessive about turning off lights and electronics before leaving, and he was correct. We had left the bathroom light on in our haste. I ignored him and rushed us down the frozen pavement, stepping on sharp rocks and sticks and not even comprehending it. Adrenaline surged through my veins. I didn't know what we were heading toward. All I knew is what we were heading away from. The snow was falling much harder by this point. I could already see it collecting in a pile on Kate's head. Her nose was beet red and dripping with snot. I needed to get her inside. But where? I looked ahead and saw a light off in the distance. The Garland's house. I'd said maybe a grand total of 6 words to Mr. and Mrs. Garland my entire life, but that was our one option. It was in their house that we would seek refuge. My house was now around the corner and out of sight, but I did not let up the pace until George tripped on something and landed in a dark puddle. "Hey," he screamed indignantly, looking back at his stumbling block. In the glow of the distant streetlight, I could see George had fallen into blood. A dead man lay face up and eyes open on the sidewalk. Snow had fallen onto most of him, and he had been mostly invisible until Georgie's feet had connected with his midsection. I remembered the dark stain I had seen on our intruder's knife. "Come on," I pled. wrenching my eyes away from the grisly scene as I pulled George to his feet. We ran for another 60 seconds, maybe, and finally reached the Garlands' front door. The window into their parlor was open, and a fire was roaring. Mr. and Mrs. Garland sat, drinking tea, in cozy armchairs. I pounded ferociously on their door. They answered together, utter bewilderment stamped on their faces. I handed Kate to Mrs. Garland and collapsed into tears. The police arrived at my home 15 minutes later and apprehended the man, unconscious, lying in a crumpled heap on the floor of our basement bathroom. They discovered him with a fractured skull, many deep lacerations from the window of Kate's room, and his intestines partially protruding from the wound on his gut. He had slipped in his attempt to climb where we had climbed, hit his head, and knocked himself out. Apparently, he confessed under questioning that he was a member of a strange cult, a cult which, as far as anyone can tell, does not exist. He claimed to have been taking part in a ritual which required the sacrifice of a pure soul, and my autistic brother had been his target that night. My parents have not shared with me all the details of what happened after that night, but as far as I know, our intruder is currently rotting in a cell. The man he killed, the man lying on the sidewalk, was a friend of my father who lived two streets over. He had called his wife on the phone not long before he died, informing her of a suspicious man dressed in black stalking around the neighborhood. My parents arrived home from their date to find police swarmed around the block and their home a crime scene. My father relocated at work, and we had moved across the Rockies to Salt Lake City just 2 weeks later. Kate is now a bratty middle schooler. As far as I'm concerned, she's perfect. George, now 21, hasn't changed a bit, but he loses his mind if someone knocks on a window. As for me, I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie now. I climb mountains with narrow trails and steep ridges. I go cave diving in places where you shouldn't. All, I think, in an attempt to recreate the fearful intensity of that one snowy night long ago. But it never works. The closest I come is when I'm alone in my room in the dead of night, when I'm reading your worst stories about your worst times and the things that chase you in your dreams. Then, and then alone, is when the real fear sets in.
I really love Craigslist. I'd estimate I've met maybe 300 people for buying and selling stuff, and for the most part, everyone was nice and harmless. However, I did run into two creeps who made me rethink meeting strangers alone to sell stuff. For your information, I was an early 20s female at the time. First guy, it's 2009. I'm staying with my parents for Christmas holidays in a small town in Florida. I'm going through my childhood room and cleaning out the closet to find a giant CD holder full of maybe 100 really shitty CDs. I think Nickelback, Aqua, and all that sort of stuff. It's the 21st century, no one uses CDs anymore. I figure I'd try and sell the CDs on Craigslist. I put up a listing, 100 CDs from the late 90s and early to mid 2000s. Mix of pop and rock, all for $35. The next day, I get an email from a guy named John, around 2 p.m. He said that he's in town temporarily, and that he wants the CDs. He says he can pick them up after dinner, around 8 p.m. I email him back my address and number, and tell him to text or call whenever he's on the way. 8 p.m. comes and goes. I figure I've been stood up, which happens often on Craigslist. No big deal. My dad works for a liquor company, and would often do demonstration nights at restaurants and bars, and would come home at a bar closing time. This night, he gets home around 3 a.m. I'm in college and a total night owl, so I'm still up probably eating junk food, surfing the web, and watching horror flicks. I hear a car pull up, look out the window, and I don't see him sitting in his car eating food. He often stops at Taco Bell on his way home and eats it in the car, so my mum doesn't know he's cheating on his diet. Maybe 10 minutes later, my dad comes in and shouts my name. "Someone's here to see you. Can you please tell me why there's a strange man showing up at our house at 3 a.m? "Huh?" I go downstairs, and my dad says some guy pulled up in the driveway and asked me by name. I walk outside with my dad, and this guy, who's maybe mid-30s, gets out his car. He says he's the Craigslist guy who wanted to buy my CDs. My dad goes back in the house. I tell the guy it's really, really late to be stopping by, especially without texting first. However, since I'm awake, I go grab the CDs. He then proceeds to drone on about why he's buying the CDs. He says he's engaged to a woman who he loves very much, and all he wants to do is make her happy. He said that last week, someone broke into her car and stole all her CDs. She was really upset, and he wanted a bunch of CDs she used to have. Weird thing is, I didn't list any artists or bands because I was lazy, but I didn't think much about that at the time. Anyway, he said he was getting it for her for a Christmas surprise. He said he was staying with his future in-laws somewhere nearby, and their family barbecue ran really late, which is why he never made it at 8 p.m. By this point, I've lost interest and say something along the lines of, "That's sweet. Next time you should probably call or text either the Craigslister instead of just showing up." I hand him the CDs, he hands me cash, and I go back inside. 3 days later, I start getting texts from an unknown number. "Hey, I don't know my way around this town. Care to tour guide? I could really use a massage. Where can I get a massage in this town? You're Asian, do you massage? Would you take $40 for 1 hour? Happy ending." Me, finally texting back. "Who the fuck is this?" "Him. Oh, sorry. I bought the CDs from you the other day. Do you squirt?" I didn't respond, obviously. I show my friends that night, and we laugh it off. Then the next day, I get more texts. "I still have your address. I'm at the Bank of America near your neighborhood. I just got $40, babe. Only 3 minutes away. Are you home? Why are you ignoring me? I'm almost here." I immediately run downstairs to tell my dad and mum. It was nighttime, so we shut off all the lights outside and inside my house. My mum, little brother and I went in my parents' room in the back of the house. My dad hid behind the curtains of the front bay window with a shovel in his hand. A few minutes later, I heard him run down the front hallway, fling the front door open and run outside. We heard some faint shouting, so we all walked out of the bedroom. By that time, my dad came back in with a shovel, his face red and his hair all messed up. Apparently, the guy came driving down our street really slow. My dad recognized the car and went running outside with the shovel, yelling obscenities at the guy. The guy peeled off and never came back or texted me again. So here's my story about the second guy. I was moving from Florida to DC and was going to load up my car as much as I could with stuff. However, I lived on the third floor plus a bit of a walk from my assigned parking lot, so I figured I could use some help. I posted an ad on Craigslist gigs. I said I was looking for someone to help me load some heavy items like TVs, desks, etc. in my car. Less than an hour's worth of work, and I'd pay $45 or whatever. I give the very first responder my number and address, and he shows up. He was probably 5'8", 350 pounds of pure fat. The sweat and smell coming off this guy in the Florida heat was pretty nauseating, but I didn't care as long as he did the job right. While he was carting heavy stuff, I was loading lighter things. Whenever I'd go upstairs to grab another load, he'd hurry after me so he could walk up the stairs behind me. I had the door propped open, so he didn't have to worry about me needing to unlock the door first or anything. When he'd follow me up the stairs, he'd make these weird grunting noises, like, and I'd assume it was because he was out of shape. Eventually, he's loaded everything properly, save for some sweat smears on my stuff. I pay him, and he drives off. I go back in my place and finish loading and cleaning. I go out maybe 45 minutes later to put another load in my car, and I see his truck is back, parked across the street from mine. He's sitting in the driver's seat, looking at me. When he sees me notice him, he looks away. I walk over to his window and knock. He rolls it down, and I ask if he needs any help or if he was lost. I was really confused as to why he'd come back, and I knew he didn't live near me. He didn't say anything, he just rolled his window back up and drove off. Okay, whatever. Of course, 5 minutes later, my phone starts blowing up. I didn't recognize the number, so I didn't answer the calls. Then texts start rolling in. Him. I bet you taste salty and sweet. Me. Who's this? Him. You know what. Him. What are you up to tonight? Can I come back over? I get this sinking feeling it's the Craigslist guy. He had never called me about the job when I gave him the number, so I didn't know what his number was. Him. I like your pink panties. I then realized he was looking up my dress when I was walking up the stairs. I immediately feel like a total idiot for wearing a dress that day. He then started dialing my number over and over again. I didn't know how to do the block number thing through Sprint, so I just had to turn my phone off. Later, I was with my guy friend grabbing a bite and turned my phone back on. I got another text from the guy about how he wanted to toss me around like a ragdoll and tie me up and make me beg for it. I showed the text to my friend and tell him the story. The Craigslist creep proceeds to then start blowing up my phone again. So my friend answers and said he's going to cut his knob off and feed it to the dog if he ever contacts me again. I moved the next day, so I never had to worry about him randomly showing up in his truck again. Since then, I've brought and sold stuff on Craigslist, but I've always made people meet me at a public place before. I also stalk people's email addresses, Google Plus accounts, etc. I worked as a Walmart cashier for a little over a year. I quit in August of 2015 when I went away to college. As a cashier, you see a lot of people in a day, especially at Walmart, and after a while, you don't even see people's faces when you look at them. But there are some people that you see so often that you start to recognize them and sometimes learn their names. There was this one guy, always in the same Green Bay Packers hoodie and Chicago Cubs baseball cap, that would often seek out my line, no matter how long it was, just so he could stare at me and rarely say a word. Whenever he did say anything to me, he would always lean across the register to get a close look at my face. He always gave me a really bad vibe, but when I asked other cashiers about him, they said he had never been weird around them. One of the girls even said that he was a close family friend. After that, I dropped the issue. One night, after I'd been working there about a year, I was working a 2 to 11 shift. Those shifts were always the worst, because you would be there for 3, sometimes 4 front-end managers, but also because it takes the chunk out of your day where you can actually do anything. So I'm down with the self-checkout. It's 10:15, so I'm counting down the minutes until I can shut it down at 10 to 11. The creepy guy comes in the front door and makes a beeline for me at self-checkout. When I see him come in, I instantly get nervous. He walks up and says, "Can I still buy a phone in Card Electronics?" I told him I only worked as a cashier on the front end, so I didn't know anything about electronics, but he could go back and check. He seemed peeved by this answer, but he walks away without another word. About 10 minutes later, he comes up with a prepaid phone card and says there's no one at the register in electronics. So I activate his card and hand it to him, telling him have a good night, but he pushes the card back at me without saying a word, and I say, "Is there something wrong?" To which he replies, "These 10 minutes aren't on my phone yet, are they?" I was confused by this statement because of course they weren't, he had just brought the card. I shook my head and he waved his card in front of my face. "Why on earth are you just standing there? Reactivate my phone." When he talked, he was so close I could smell his breath. I was so scared. I wanted to put a call into the CSM so that someone would come down and help me. This is where I should mention that I'm about 5'3" tall, and he is closer to 6'5" probably. He's very stocky and was towering over me, and the thought that he could easily overpower me crossed my mind, but I get so nervous whenever men yell or cuss at me because my dad was never the type to yell or cuss. I took the card out of his hand and he slammed the cell phone on the scanner. I was trying not to let him know I was nervous, but I was terrified. I knew that I had never put minutes on a prepaid phone before, but I don't dare tell him that, in fear of what he might do. So I read the directions, pick up his phone, dial the number, and as I'm putting in the card number, his phone runs out in minutes. I try to call back and get an error message. I'm at a loss. I meekly hand him the phone back and say, "Sorry, something went wrong. I don't know what's happening." As soon as I say it, he takes his phone, opens it up, and tries to dial someone. And when it doesn't work, he looks at me with furious eyes. He screams, "What on earth did you do to my phone? What the hell?" His voice is echoing in the store, and unfortunately, we haven't got to the end of second shift rush yet, so there is no one around. He closes his phone and opens it again, trying to make another call, but it doesn't work. He throws the phone down on the scanner again. He says, "I don't know what you did to my phone, but you better fix it." But this comes much more quietly, practically a whisper. At this point, I'm worried he's going to put his hands on me, and I don't know what to do. I put in a call for the CSM from my register and say, "I've called someone that might be able to help, but we're at a shift change right now, so it might be faster to take it to the customer service desk." He picks up his phone off the podium, still mumbling under his breath that I messed up his phone, and I'm hoping that I can get out of there before he comes back, or at least have someone else down at the self-check with me. Another 15 minutes go by, and I don't see him again. As I'm picking up items that people left at the registers, getting ready to shut them down for the night, he comes back and stands by the podium. He still looks completely annoyed, and my stomach sank. He made that finger motion that means come here without saying anything, and for some reason, that makes me even more nervous. When I'm standing in front of him, he leans so close to my face that I think he's about to kiss me or bite me or God knows what. I try to take a step back, but he takes a step forward when I do. A creepy grin comes across his face and he says, "We go up there, fixed it. Simple fix. But next time, I expect you to know what to do. Understand?" I nod because I don't think I can speak. He gets impossibly closer before saying, "I'm sorry I raised my voice. I should never have done that, especially to a pretty girl like you." When he had the last part, he lightly used his finger to brush my bangs to the side. I took a step back and he said, "Let me make it up to you. Let me buy you a drink." I shake my head and say, "No thank you, I'm only 19. He says, "So we get a couple of beers and go back to my place?" Again, I shake my head. "No, really, it's okay. I'm not much of a drinker. I have an early morning tomorrow." He looks displeased with this answer and says, "Tell you what, I'll wait over here by the door just in case you change your mind." I smile at him weakly and tell him to have a good night. When I see him walk through the security things, I quickly shut down the registers and sign off mine. I then run over to the CSM to tell them the whole thing. The third shift CSM that I tell looks at me like I'm lying, and when I finish says, "I know him. He wouldn't hurt a fly. He doesn't have it in him. He's just being dramatic." She then turns to another, older cashier behind her, shakes her head and mumbles, "Teenagers." I ask if I can have someone walk me to my car, and they tell me that management is in a meeting and the security guy went home already. So I clocked out and went to the bathroom. I waited in the bathroom for about 10 minutes before coming out and attempting to go to my car. When I walked around the corner through the security things, he wasn't sitting on the bench right there, like I had been expecting. I relaxed a little before I realised he was standing just outside the door, far enough away to keep it from closing, smoking a cigarette. He had turned his back to the door though. Luckily, I never went out of the front doors. I always went down the corridor and out the side door. Quietly, I closed the door behind me, so maybe I wouldn't catch his attention. I rushed to my car, which was, fortunately, very close to the building. As I'm quickly walking to my car, I hear him shout, "Hey, why are you avoiding me? Come here!" At this point, I take off in a full sprint, which is not easy because I'm wearing Sperry's, so it's like running in clogs. I get to my car, get in, lock the doors as I'm starting it, and don't even bother with my seatbelt. By that point, he had made it almost all the way to my car and was still yelling, telling me he just wanted to talk. I took off as fast as I could and took the longest way home, which had the most turns and twists that I could. When I got home, I told my dad about the experience, and he was so angry that no one answered my calls or believed me that he called the store manager the next day and complained. I was never contacted about his complaint, but from that night on, whenever I saw the guy, I would run to the bathroom, or if I couldn't get away, I would put out my lane close sign and turn off the light so he couldn't get in my lane. You always hear people talking about the people at Walmart as being trashy, but they never tell you the select few who are scary as hell. These are some strange experiences from a camping trip in Northern Ontario I went on back when I was a little kid with my mum and dad. I want to preface this by saying that despite the things I've written about, it was still a good experience. My parents split amicably when I was very young, and I didn't actually live with my dad. I still got to see him though, and these kinds of trips were a bonding experience and were always pretty fun. I just don't want this story to overshadow that. Alright, so on to the story. My dad and stepmom rented a tiny cabin in Northern Ontario one summer through a family friend. I don't know exactly where it was, but I'm certain it was well north of Midland, the regular cottage country for Toronto folks. The cabin was on a lake, and the owner ferried us there on a tiny motorboat. This wasn't an island, mind you. I think there just weren't any roads to access it. Some strange things happened on this trip, and while there isn't a single cohesive timeline here, and I'm not an experienced writer, I'll try my best to document them. I've itemized specific events to make it clearer. The owner had just left the canoe at the cabin, and we took it out on a lot of trips on the lake, usually later in the day. I was obsessed with frogs and fish and wildlife as a kid, and this lake was loaded with marshes, so I loved these outings. I remember one of them in particular. It was almost sunset, and we were hiking heading back through one of the marshes, and I heard a faint humming similar to a transformer coming from the tree line on the shore. My dad and stepmom noticed it too, as it grew louder. It stopped all of a sudden a few moments later, but so did everything else. The sounds of birds, frogs croaking, and any other wildlife had completely dropped off and stayed silent. Nothing else strange happened on our way back, but it was creepy as hell. The cabin was on a shoreline, but there wasn't a beach or anything close to one. It was actually a very steep and rocky shore around the entire area, but once you got in the water, there was sand. Mussels and crayfish thrived here, and my dad got the idea to catch some for cooking. Freshwater mussels taste terrible, by the way. Don't try it. My dad isn't a woodsman by any means, but he is a very crafty and resourceful guy. We canoed to a sandy area close to the shore, and we waded out to catch mussels. On both sides of the water here, the shore was very steep rocks, like two floors up with thick forest at the top. At some point during our escapade, I caught a glimpse of something among the trees on the opposite shore. I couldn't make it out very well, but it was white, almost like the texture of a birch, and very lanky. I remember thinking that it definitely wasn't a person, but it wasn't too far from the general shape of one. It was staggering around, lethargically and slowly. If it was an animal, then something was definitely wrong with it. I waded over to my dad and told him to look up there, and by that point it was gone. Because of this, I'm still not 100% sure that it isn't something I imagined. I was 9 or 10 at the time, but I remember seeing it again on the opposite shore on our way back. This one I don't actually remember, instead my dad told me about it. On one of our canoeing outings, my dad and my stepmom decided to visit the little peninsula on the other side of the lake close to the marshes area. We all got there and dragged the canoe onto the little shoreline there was, and walked inland single file. There wasn't a path, but the trees weren't particularly dense either, enough to see water when you look back. Pretty soon I noticed that the entire place was covered in mushrooms, and live trees had given way to downed and dead trees further inland. This was unusual, because it didn't look like there had been a forest fire or anything like that. They were just dead. It also started to smell really, really bad. Not wanting to endanger us by going further, we all turned back. He didn't want to let on that he was nervous because I was young at the time, but he told me that he was seriously freaked out. We stayed clear of that peninsula for the rest of the trip. This is something that my dad told me that happened to him during this trip a couple of years ago. He went hiking by himself at some point, and when he was deeper into the woods, everything around him just stopped. No sound whatsoever, no movement, no wind or leaves falling. It all returned a minute later and nothing else eventful happened for the rest of his hike. This one isn't really scary, as much as it is weird, I guess. We spent most nights having fires outside, and one night my dad and I stayed up watching X-Files on this tiny black TV. I'm not actually sure how this place even had power, since it wasn't accessible by road, but maybe it had a generator, or even a small PV battery setup for all I know. There wasn't much other than a couple of lights, that TV, and a small water pump to the lake. Anyway, I was young, and X-Files was creepy as hell to me. During one of the episodes, we both heard that humming coming from outside. Like when we were on the canoe, it was faint, but definitely there. We went outside with a flashlight to see if we could identify it, but we couldn't see anything. We didn't want to go into the woods this late or take the canoe out, and it sounded like it was far away enough, so we just went back inside. It was intermittent throughout the rest of the night, sometimes getting louder, sometimes quieting down. In the morning, our water wasn't working. My dad went to investigate, and apparently the power pump cabling had been messed with. It was an easy fix, but strange nonetheless. This was probably the most unsettling one that I remember. I'd wake up earlier than everyone else in the morning, because I was pretty hyped to go out and catch toads, frogs, and whatever else I could find. I even set a trap for a chipmunk one time, and successfully caught it. I remember one morning, I had just woken up before sunrise, and was still in bed. In the window adjacent to my bed, I saw something that usually wasn't there. It was half a face poking around the edge of a window and staring into our cabin, sickly pale orange with giant black holes where the eyes were supposed to be. This thing was definitely not human. I freaked out and hid under the covers, and eventually fell back asleep. When I woke up again, everyone was also awake, and there was no sign of anything there. I always thought of this particular experience as something that I just imagined after just waking up. It had to be. About a month ago, I met up with my dad while visiting my home city, and we were talking about this trip a bit again. He mentioned that there were quite a few times he felt uneasy on the trip. For example, my dad usually goes jogging early in the morning for exercise, and it's a habit he still keeps up to this day. He decided to abstain a couple of mornings at the cabin though, because he felt there was something he just couldn't place that was creeping him the hell out. I connected this one with the window incident after our conversation, but when I did it, it really made me think about this entire trip, and is one reason I decided to write a post about it. I can't undeniably prove any of what's happened, but for what it's worth, you can look through my post history and see that I don't tell these stories regularly. I'm going to end this here now, because it's gotten a lot longer than I expected, and it's all pretty disjointed. I was a little kid at the time, and these things happened, and I don't remember everything, or even the order of the events. I'm certain that my dad and stepmom experienced stuff themselves, but I didn't think to ask last time I saw, because I simply wasn't thinking about the entire trip that deeply. As a third year university student, I'd like to think that pizza, gyros, and hamburgers are important staples of my cost-effective and not really nutritious nutritional needs. Needless to say, it wasn't long before I became besties with the guys running the local pizza parlor 3 blocks from my house. These guys were super cool. I met them for the first time when my best friend Sharon, Shah, and I went to buy pizza for our movie night. I wasn't too jazzed on the movie night because my lesbianist roommate Sam insisted on joining in. Now, I'm not homophobic. Shah is the biggest lesbian out there. She thinks I have a very nice butt. But I was Samophobic though. She pretty much decided early on that I was hiding my true lesbian nature and had been trying to get me to accept myself for what she believed me to be for like 3 months. This meant that movie nights with Sam mostly consisted of that one where Cuba Gooding goes on a gay cruise. That one with the chick working in a flower shop. So, I wasn't too stoked on the movie night. These mostly ended in deep conversations about the importance of revealing your true sexuality. And neither was Shah, because Sam had a way of making things really awkward. I told these pizza dudes about my roommate and her crazy movie antics, and they tried to help us out by inviting Shah and I to come back at midnight to watch a horror movie on the projector that they had set up in the dining area. I'm pretty big on horror movies, so to me, it sounded like an awesome idea. Shah thought it sounded like a plot to kidnap and murder us. We were going though. Over the next couple of months, I became really tight with the guys, and I would come over every Friday night for a scary movie night and discounted pizza. The dudes were cool, and a good way to get time away from Sam, who had taken to tracking my movements like Dr. Bounty Hunter. The guys were pretty successful with their pizza, and pretty soon they'd have to hire more drivers, which is when I met Bill. Bill is pretty much your stereotypical old guy who failed at life. He was in his 40s, but he looked like he was pushing 60. He was constantly high and never showed up to work on time, but always had a really measly and long-winded excuse full of anecdotes of why his life as a pizza delivery guy was so hard. Customers hated him too. When they opened their front door, he would push his way into the house and put their pizza on the kitchen counter or table, something he thought would get him a bigger tip. He wouldn't leave their front door until they gave him what he felt was a big enough tip. If they didn't have money, then he'd tell them that they could tip him in the pot. If they didn't have that, then he'd start to yell at them for being cheap assholes. One night, I was studying, and had to order, and instead of going out. Normally the guys only sent the call delivery guys to my place, but that night, rotation hit Bill. He stood in my doorway, chatting me up for a long time, and told me that the guys called him Big Bill for a reason. So obviously, Bill needed to get fired like yesterday. The guys do what they have to do, and give him notice. I come into the shop on Bill's last working night, and talk to my buddy Pete about the firing. Apparently Bill was taking it really well, and was just about to finish his last delivery of the night. I hung around to talk to Pete about his troubles with his crazy girlfriend. Actually, she was a pretty nice lady. Bill comes in while we're talking, and tries to join in the conversation. I was standing at the counter, with Pete behind Bill at my side. Bill starts offering me rides home. I decline, but hey, dude gives me the skeevies. He kept insisting that it was on his way, but I just kept telling him that it was only like a 15-minute walk and that I'd be fine. He started to get pouty, and then said that I didn't want to get in the car with him because I thought he was creepy. He hit the nail on the head. But since this is Canada, and we're polite to a fault, I just laughed it off and insisted that I'd really rather not. Bill kept pouting and then went outside to have a smoke in his car. On his way out, he grabbed my ass. This sort of abuse isn't uncommon for my bum, but it still pisses me the hell off when it happens. As soon as Bill was out the door and halfway to his car, I told Pete about the ass grab. Pete was a total dude about it and told me that it was a good ass, and that he'd probably done the same if he had the balls. I was pissed as a wet cat, and it was getting late, so I started to trudge back home. At the crosslight, a grey piece of junk that I recognised as Bill's car drove up to me. Bill rolled down his window and asked if I was sure that I didn't want to ride. Even after his charming ass grab, I was still pretty keen on not getting in the car with him. So once again I said, "No thanks, dude," and he pulled a right, presumably to loop back into the back parking lot of the pizza shop. He shot me a smile and a creepy little wave. I hated that dude. I kept on walking until I reached the next crosswalk. When I was halfway across, a grey little shit beater drove up behind me and blasted on the horn. The car drove past me, so I figured it was just Bill being an aggressive dick like usual. I walked down my main street, keeping an eye out for him, until I reached the gate leading from the street to the backyard of my house. I'm usually pretty nervous entering the backyard, because it's dark as the bottom of the ocean in that bitch. So I grabbed my keys between my fingers for a makeshift pair of brass knuckles for just in case. Always good in the backyard, but when I turned the corner to reach the front of the house, I saw a grey shitty shit beater parked in the curb. One thought went through my head. Crap. So I'm not super rational, and even though I was standing right at the entrance to my landlord's basement suite, I instead bolted for an extra 20 feet to my front door. I felt like I was going a million miles an hour, and that he was going at like 0.3 Michael Miles pace per minute. I reached the door and fumbled for my keys, when I heard this car door shut. I dropped my keys on the ground. I whipped down to pick them up, and I heard him whistle. I jammed the keys into my door, turned around and slammed it shut behind me as fast as I could and turned the lock. Suddenly, my life got really quiet. I didn't turn on any of the lights. I just went to the front window and watched. I couldn't make out Bill. I could see that he was in his car from the lit end of his cigarette. I called Sam, but she wasn't home, so instead I called Pete on the phone. Our conversations basically went like this.
Italian mob pizza. Pete here. What can I... Crap, Pete. What the hell? Bill followed me home, man. Whoa, what? That creepy ass dude, the ass grabbing Bill, is outside my house. Dude, he's supposed to be on the other side of town. I asked him to do a delivery at 10 Mile like 20 minutes ago. Well, he's here. He's probably just pulling this shit because he thinks you're pretty, and it's his last shift. Are you sure it's him?
It's not like my town has a shortage of grey beater cars, but I think I'd seen this one enough times in one night to make a positive ID.
Yeah, dude, it's definitely him. Okay, I'll be over in 15 minutes. Alright, see you soon.
I hung up on Pete and moved away from the front big window so that I could hide in my room, where I could look through the smaller window that he was less likely to see me in. All of our doors are locked and are really heavy duty, so I feel pretty secure in my own room. I didn't turn on my bedroom lights, but I crumpled once I locked the door. I sat there for a little bit trying to calm myself down by breathing. I heard my landlord watching a movie downstairs in his living room, but I didn't get up until I heard the doorbell. The only way to reach the door to the downstairs suite was to walk down the stairs leading to the front door and then take the next set of stairs down. I was fucking determined to get my landlord, a way bigger guy than Pete, but I needed to get past our windowed front door first, where Bill would be able to see me if I was at the door. At this point, I was pretty scared, and being scared makes me angry, so I essentially said, "Fuck it," to myself and went down the stairs to the front door. I could see his head and the left half of his body through the window panel. He saw me try and sneak past and called out, "Hey Emma, it's me, Bill, from Generic Italian Mob Boss Pizza. Pete sent me over with a free pizza for you." I noped myself right down the stairs to my landlord's door. I knocked and he groggily opened it for me. I told him the situation, which basically went down like this. "Landlord, creepy pizza guy followed me home and now he won't leave." My landlord is pretty much the coolest dude ever, so he snaps awake and heads up to the front door. He uses his adult voice and tells Bill that Emwat did not order pizza and that if he doesn't leave he's gonna call the police. Bill doesn't say anything, but we see him walk back to his car. He actually did have a pizza box, but probably one meant for another dude. My landlord was tired, so he gave me a quick, "Come get me immediately when crazy shit like this happens," and then went to bed. I watched Bill in his car from the big window, keeping my screen on and lit as bright as it could go, so that he could see that I had my phone ready to dial. He started up his car and rolled down the road. I called Pete at the pizza place to tell him that my landlord handled it and that he didn't have to come anymore. Pete waited for Bill to come back and then told him to never come back to the pizza place or near me again. It's been almost 2 years since then and I never heard from or heard about Bill since then. In the end, I didn't call the cops, which if you read my post about the tomboy and the mountain goats, you'd know that that's the kind of way I was raised. I don't know if there's a cultural difference between Canadians and Americans, but only once have I called the cops in my life, when I was too young to deal with the situation myself. In 2006, I was a college student at ASU. I lived in an off-campus apartment on the ground floor, and it was a block off a major street here in Phoenix called Baseline. These details are important. In the summer of 2006, Phoenix, Arizona was plagued by two serial killers. One was a Phoenix shooter, who ended up being a team of two guys randomly shooting people, and the other was the Baseline killer, a rapist and murderer. Having two serial killers put the entire city on edge, and everyone was talking about it. I even saw articles in Time or the Newsweek about the situation. So the fall 2006 semester had just started. Now you may have heard this, but Phoenix is hot in August. It would get stuffy in my apartment, and so I'd leave the car window cracked a little because the morning air is nice. The blinds provided visual cover. Anyway, one morning, a strange sound woke me up. It was the crack of dawn at 4:45 a.m, and the sun was just barely coming up. The sound was a tapping sound, and it seemed intentional, but I thought it could be a bird or some branches or something trivial. I ignored it, and it went away for a bit. After about 90 seconds of silence, the tapping returned. And it was absolutely purposeful. In my mind, I thought it was my boyfriend, who thought it was cute to try and scare me sometimes. I decided I'd be a bit of a brat and make him wait, but I was also getting really angry. How dare he pull a prank when I'm trying to sleep? This is just like him. I'm gonna give him a piece of my mind about disturbing my sleep like this. The tapping continued. At a certain point, I get up to get a glass of water, still being in the mindset of wanting to annoy my stupid boyfriend, who thought this would be funny. I saw some movement through the slit in the blinds. I marched over and yanked the blind so I could see. Definitely not my boyfriend. I said very loudly, "What the fuck?" He sort of seemed taken back by my anger, but only slightly. The man I saw will be with me forever, or more specifically, his eyes and the feeling they gave me were insanely creepy. Honestly, words can't do justice to how terrifying his eyes were. They look like black orbs with no white in them. Absolutely predatory. When I see pictures of Ted Bundy or Charles Manson, that's exactly what he looked like. Even if you saw a picture of how they looked, it's different when you experience it in person. He was crouched down, like an umpire. He had dark pants, a dark purple shirt, and a dark night hat. He had dark skin. I thought he was Hispanic, but I later found out he was a light-skinned black guy. You'll know how I learned his name later. Anyway, after I yelled, "What the fuck," at him, he whispers to me, "Can I talk to you?" If you want to know how insanely creepy that is to hear, just whisper that sentence aloud to yourself right now. It sends chills down my spine when I think about how it sounded. His hand subtly moved towards his waist. I later learned that he would blitz attack his victims, and he probably had a gun. Now, this is about a 3-second interaction at this point. For some reason, I thought of Ted Bundy and how he pretended to be crippled to target his victims. I thought of my mum telling me to not be nice to strangers, don't be afraid to be a bitch. My thinking wasn't as calculated as all that, but it was more of the nano-processing of how I was dealing with the situation. So when he whispered that, I started yelling at him, "Hell no, get the fuck out of here, douchebag." I shut the window angrily and locked it. I lay back down and wondered if I'd been too mean. What if he needed help? But then why would he be? Tapping and whispering if he was in trouble. He's probably a creep after all. I was too annoyed to get back to sleep, but I sort of laid back down. I told my roommate about it about an hour later, and she sort of jokingly asked if it could have been the Baseline killer. When she said that, my heart sank. His face looked exactly like it did in the police sketches that were on the billboards everywhere. The only problem is that those billboards showed him with dreads. The man at my window had no dreads. Apparently, he was some sort of disguise artist who'd wear wigs. Updating the police sketch would have been a nice move, but they didn't. I called the Phoenix police, and the detective I talked to agreed that it sounded like his MO. The suspect would say something to throw off his target, and then he'd blitz attack. The detective said that my angry response probably made me seem like too much of a hassle, and moved on. The only problem with that, I thought the guy looked Hispanic, and the detective said many witnesses described him as black. I thought they might want to come out and try samples or surveillance video or something, but I didn't hear back from the detective. My parents freaked out. They got us knives, pepper spray, and put up signs. We tried to leave the apartment complex, and we learned another tenant had complained about the exact same thing. I never learned the details, but this idiot was apparently going around the damn complex trying to find a target. The stupid apartment wouldn't let us out of our lease, so we moved to a second floor apartment right above our old unit. Side note, the neighbours who moved into our old unit were horrible, obnoxious tweakers who would do meth, play pitbull on repeat for hours, and have knife fights at 11 a.m. on weekdays. There were times I wondered if they might be worse than the actual serial killer who came to my window. So that unit was cursed somehow. Anyway, on the 4th of September 2006, they arrested Mark Godu. I think the detective didn't call me back because they were days away from arresting Godu. When I saw his mugshot, I was sick but also relieved. He was absolutely the guy outside my window. To me, he looked like he could be Hispanic. You can judge for yourself if you Google it. He's on death row in Arizona now. His wife tried to mount some campaign to show how the police were framing him or something. On a personal level, it certainly would make for an interesting coincidence if the framed, innocent guy was also whispering like a creep and tapping my window. The other cool thing about this story is that I had a really bad eating disorder at the time, and about 8 months after this happened, I got in solid recovery. I never would have experienced how wonderful life could be if the slightest thing would have changed that morning in 2006. I can't think of something more scarier than a serial killer tapping your window. That actually happened to me, and if it happens to you, just scare them right back. Don't be afraid to be downright rude to someone who's injecting themselves into your space. It could save your life if you're not afraid to throw your weight around and tell someone off. During some cave exploring, my family and some friends were in some deep caves and we were heading out. We found a slit about knee high in the rock. Getting on your stomach, there was a tight squeeze you could get into, and it led to a small crawl space in the rock, with quartz growing on the ceiling, making beautiful crystal ceiling displays. We went in one by one, and if you were claustrophobic, this place was your worst nightmare. Most times you could feel the ceiling on your back, and the floor on your stomach every time you took a breath. We went deep in, and it was just incredible, like a small well tucked away within solid rock. I had made it as deep as I could go, before the path wound to the left and covered with stalagmites and stalactites of sediment. Everyone was having a grand time, and we started feeling some trickles of water on our backs. It turns out it was raining outside, and with the way the crawl space dipped down before flattening out, the whole place would fill up with rainwater pretty damn quickly, with the only way for it to drown out was the way we came in. It started as trickles before it went into streams and began to pool up. Being the furthest away from the exit, and you can only just crawl flat on your stomach with jagged crystal pointing down from the ceiling, I started to panic a bit. Everyone crawled out as fast as they could as the water kept coming in, the streams growing larger and larger. We left one at a time as fast as we could, but it wasn't fast enough. I could feel the water coming on my chin as I crawled behind my brother. Each inch I took forward felt so painfully slow that I could feel the walls compress around me, and the water was unrelenting, now splashing against my panic squirms. I got out just as the water was up to my lips, and everyone got out safely. I'm not eager to try that again.
Well, y'all, that is my time. I want to say thank y'all to everyone who tuned in, who called in, who inboxed, and everything in between. Join me right here, same time, same place, tomorrow. Well, we will be venturing into day 25, well, night 25 of the 31 Days of Horror series. before I get out of here, I'm going to leave y'all with my thought of the day, or whatever. And that is, never give more to someone than you are willing to give. Because sometimes when you give too much and it's not reciprocated, you become resentful. So make sure that the energy that you're pouring into is the energy that you will be giving back. With that being said, love, peace, and blessings. Pray before you lay. I love y'all, and good night.